From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Playwright and director Kenny Leon is back in Georgia.
Can you please help me get home?
Well, where is that?
I'm trying to get to Omaha, where I was born.
Oh, no can do. See, that falls under the heading of transporting a minor across state lines. I'm afraid for something like that, you gonna have to see The Wiz.
That's from a 2015 production of The Wiz, directed by Kenny Leon. We'll talk to him about teaching at Kennesaw State. First, though, we talked yesterday about the psychology of white supremacy.
Other groups are less than, and thus I should be allowed to isolate with my group because we will thrive as a result of not having multiculturalism and diversity. So, I mean, you can use euphemisms for it and say it's about white nationalism, but at the crux of it, it's about white supremacy.
Roxanne Donovan is a psychology professor at Kennesaw State University. Here are your first thoughts on how to avoid becoming an extremist.
My name is John Park, and for me, what worked was school. I went to college, I went to a junior college first, and it kept my mind occupied.
We've also talked about what Confederate icons really symbolize.
If we were going to use these monuments as teaching tools, our teachers would have started a long time ago, and they didn't.
That's Chuck Reese of The Bitter Southerner. Carl Owens in Vidalia writes to us, if we remove monuments to the generals of Southern Confederacy, then intellectual honesty requires those that honored Washington, Jefferson, who were slave owners, Andrew Jackson, Ulysses Grant, Will T. Sherman, who committed genocide on Native Americans, FDR, who imprisoned Japanese Americans, and any other monument that honors anyone who oppressed others, no matter the cause. It seems the Southern monuments are an easy target because they lost, but that certainly doesn't make it fair. We always love to hear your opinions and get your thoughts. You can call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457. Find us on Twitter or on Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. It's been 2 weeks since the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. The violence there has renewed conversations about racial relations, freedom of speech, and radicalization. Shannon Martinez of Athens knows a lot about that last one. She was a skinhead for several years, but she is not one anymore. And Shannon joins me from Athens. Good morning.
Good morning.
Just a note to our listeners, parts of this conversation may not be suitable for young ears. Now, Shannon, you actually joined a skinhead group when you were a teenager, right? Quite young.
Yes, when I was in between 15 and 16 years old.
So let's walk through what happened then and how you ended up joining that group. Because as I understand it, you yourself considered yourself to be liberal at that point.
When we would sit around the dinner table, my family tended towards much more conservative politics and arguments, whereas I took the much more liberal view. I loved the Beatles as a middle schooler and the culture of the 60s.
You described your family as having acceptable middle-class racism. What does that mean?
I don't mean that from a personal point of view at this point in my life, but the racism that is so much a part of what we deem as acceptable, where we stay silent now, where it's, you know, little jokes that involve race or little derogatory remarks if somebody cuts you off in traffic, or it's okay to start talking about property values diminishing as members of different races move into an all-white neighborhood, things like that, that they found overt racism to be abhorrent and said so. But on the other hand, there was this other conversation that was always going on.
So you went from not really buying into that acceptable racism, which again is a euphemism, to
I was in a breakdance group as a little girl a bunch of multicultural people.
Right. So how did you then end up being in a hate group?
Just before my 15th birthday, I went to a party with some friends. During that time, I was being drawn towards counterculture movements, skateboarders, and then from there, like punk rock. I never quite felt like I fit in my family. I felt like there was a lot of perfectionism that was part of my family that I never really could quite measure up. real or perceived, that was how I felt in my family. And so I didn't have a deep, strong sense of belonging. And then we moved from where I had grown up outside of Philadelphia to rural Michigan, just over the border of Ohio. And I lost all sense of personal identity that I had been building since I was young, coupled with the fact that I didn't feel a strong connection and identity as part of my family. And so I started being drawn to, like, skateboard culture and then punk rock culture, like looking for identity outside of myself. I went to a party when I was 14, just shy of my 15th birthday. And at that party, I was raped by two men. And that was how I lost my virginity. It would take me another 10 years to even be able to frame what happened to me that way. I understand now how the brain deals with trauma and why that would be so. But instead of going to my parents, I knew on some level that if I told them that, that had happened, that I would be in trouble because I had lied about where I had gone and I had been drinking. And I know that the core of who I was couldn't accept that anyone placing blame on me for this outrage, for this trauma that had happened to me, that it wasn't my fault. And that began a cycle of deep self-loathing, and because I had all of this unprocessed trauma. And so I just began to just hate myself and my body and see myself as worthless and not having any value. And that would be a slow process, really, as that kind of took over like a sickness in my being. And then so about 6 months on down the road, I broke up with the first like real boyfriend that I had. And then, you know, and then it was like the anger consumed me. And I was already involved in the punk rock movement. And there were skinheads on the periphery of that. And they were the angriest people in this already sort of angry subculture. And so I was able to identify with their anger and was like, wow, those are my people. Those are the people I want to be around.
And it sounds
and
like
all
you're saying,
you had to do was be angry.
Right. And it sounds like what you're saying is that to fit in and become, as you say, angry, part of learning to hate other people was learned. That was part of fitting into that group. Is that accurate?
Yes, I believe that is accurate. And for me, it wasn't a big step, because I hated everybody. And so, in a strange way, it was almost a relief to make my anger and the rage that I felt smaller and more focused, that instead of just raging with everything and just all the time, it was like, well, all I have to do is say, join in and say, I hate black people. I hate Jews. I hate all non-white people. And so it would be a process of that, but that I understood that was the price of admission. And it was almost a relief because it took this big amorphous, ineffable rage that I felt and at least gave it a name.
So I want to play you this comment. We talked about hate groups earlier this week, and this is a psychology professor from the University of Maryland named Ariai Kuglansky, and he's talking about why it's not a good idea to mock a skinhead or someone who is a white supremacist.
If you mock their beliefs, they're going to push back. There's going to be a blow-up. There's going to be a boomerang effect. So you must be careful not to offend their beliefs. You have to reach out to them, listen to their concerns, and provide the alternative ways of thinking.
What do you make of that mocking is not the right approach?
I have seven kids, so I am able to toe the line of saying, hey, the behavior is unacceptable. Like, what you are doing and putting forth is not acceptable on any level. But let's talk about what you believe. Let me hear you and not talk past you and not belittle you, because you clearly have a reason that you believe so strongly about this that you're willing to, you know, join a rally in Charlottesville or wherever the rally might be, or engage online. Like, you clearly hold this belief dear to you. So instead of being like, wow, you're just a worthless piece of trash, very likely they already believe that. And saying that causes an embattlement. If you refuse to truly hear someone and where they're coming from, that the tendency is to become defensive almost immediately. And so it will be completely ineffective if you are truly trying to dialogue with someone, even with an abhorrent point of view, if you just mock and belittle them, and you will entrench them further. If shame is at the root and disconnection from others and a sense of objectifying other human beings is at the root, then objectifying the person with whom you're trying to dialogue just exacerbates the problem, and there's just a deepening cycle of disconnect from others.
Well, on that note, let's bring Sammy Rangel into the conversation. He's the executive director of Life After Hate, which is a nonprofit group that helps people move away from violent extremism. And Sammy joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, Sammy.
Good morning.
So I want to play another comment from Ariai Kruglansky of the University of Maryland, a psychology professor, talking about the fact that people, just like Shannon, but people who are extremists are actually redeemable.
You know, radicalization is not a terminal disease. In the same way as a person gets radicalized, he or she can get de-radicalized, and they can also get re-radicalized. You know, the human psyche is a very fluid, malleable kind of entity.
So what do you make of this, Sammy? Because we're living in a time when people say there are some people you just can't talk to. What's your response to that?
Well, I would say you're talking to one right now, and, you know, our Formers Network within Life After Hate in other areas of work that I do is full of people who were deemed, diagnosed as incorrigible, antisocial, sociopathic, and many of the members of this group were the leaders and the faces of these hate groups, these extremely violent groups. And yet today, if you were to sit down with any one of us, if you didn't know our background, you would never guess. And if you did know our background, you might be amazed at the transition and the transformation that everyone has gone through and is going through in order to maintain that. And we're still seeing that trending coming with the people that are even newer to our organization, to our Formers group, that they are deeply in this process of transforming their narratives and their lifestyles. And in the way that they see that they need to give back to the community is second to none, if you ask me.
And we only have about a minute here, Sammy, before we take a short break. But do you agree with both Shannon that mocking is or shaming is not productive?
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, we're noticing a trend that has reemerged where this collective shame may be contributing to some of the radical feelings and ideas that people are developing currently right now in the alt-right.
We're speaking with Sammy Rangel. He's the executive director of the nonprofit group Life After Hate, and also Athens resident Shannon Martinez, who was once a skinhead. If you have ever confronted somebody with racist beliefs, tell us how that went. Or maybe you're one of those people that says those people are despicable and you can't talk to them. Give us your response. You can call us at 404-500-9457 or just reach us on social media. We continue this conversation in just a moment. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. We're talking about how to reform extremists. My guests are former skinhead Shannon Martinez. She lives in Athens, Georgia. We're also talking with Sammy Rangel, the executive director of the nonprofit group Life After Hate. And again, a word of caution, parts of this conversation may not be suitable for everyone. And I feel kind of dismissive calling you just former skinhead Shannon Martinez. What other title should I use for you?
I also volunteer with Life After Hate. The most interesting thing about me is that I'm a mom.
Of seven.
Yes, of seven.
Yeah, that is quite an amazing achievement. You have to have the patience of a saint. But
no.
Let me talk to you, to both of you about...
It's true.
I know. A new poll that just came out today, this is from the Washington Post and NBC, that says the number of people who think neo-Nazi views are acceptable has now doubled since Charlottesville. Shannon, why do you think that is?
I think a lot of that has to do with packaging and marketing. When confronted, the default position, as it was for me over 20 years ago, as it is today, is that, well, we're not really racist. We want to have everyone to have their own little areas where they live and where, you know, like where we don't think we're better than people of other races. We just want to have our own little space where we get to just do white people things and everyone can do their own ethnic things in their own little area, and it's not really about racism. And at the same time, they also say, well, you know, there's Black pride and Black lives matter. Don't our lives matter too? Don't we count for something? And people resonate with that because they don't really understand what the arguments truly are. Because what the argument really is we're white and we're better and we don't want to be polluted, so to speak, by the ongoings of people that don't look like us.
So, Sammy, let me play you this comment. These comments from former Atlanta mayor and UN ambassador Andrew Young have become controversial. Here he is speaking on NBC's Meet the Press.
The reason I feel uncomfortable condemning the Klan types is they're almost the poorest of the poor. They're the forgotten Americans. They have been used and abused and neglected. Instead of giving them affordable health care, they give them black lung jobs, and they're happy. And that just doesn't make sense in today's world.
What do you make sense of that argument, Sammy?
Well, I guess just being straightforward, I don't make sense of that. But what I do think is happening in alignment with what Shannon is saying is that a lot of the people that are feeling marginalized right now, who are newer to the so-called movement, do feel like there are some social injustices that have come out of like civil rights movement type initiatives that have tried to balance out the scale because of overt systemic racism in our historical racism in our country. And so it's a twist of the truth in a sense where we're saying that, well, because of like issues like affirmative action, whites are being denied jobs. Well, the problem with that is that we have to acknowledge history. We have to acknowledge that there was a reason for trying to balance out the system. But what they're actually saying is playing on feelings of people who feel a little bit, who have some sort of grievance with the way politics are going, with the way their lives are going, the way things seem. And then they find a way to send this message that, hey, we're with you, we're on your side, but you also have to adopt some of these other beliefs. Quite often, many of the people that I'm talking to who are still on that other side, their grievances are almost cookie cutter. You can almost predict what their grievances are going to be. And it's almost like they think they're thinking for themselves, but their comments and their viewpoints are kind of that rhetoric, are kind of like scripted for them, and then that's what they're pursuing. And so these groups feel like they're victims, and they also feel, when I was talking about collective shame, they also felt very removed from the days of slavery, very removed from the days of World War II eras. And so they're wondering why they're still carrying the burden of their ancestors and almost feel as if it's unfair of anyone to put that on them. And it's, I'm not debating whether it is or not, or whether or not there's any validity to that. But if we're going to try to understand how to dismantle some of this hate, we have to understand where their grievances are coming from as we move forward.
So we have a tweet from Lindsay who says, there's a massive difference between listening and tolerating. I think too often people confuse the two, which leads to more radicalism. And let me play one more comment. This is from an African-American blues musician named Daryl Davis, and he's sort of made it his job to go around convincing KKK members to quit.
The fact that a Klansman and a black person could sit down at the same table, enjoy the same music, that was a seed planted. So what do when you plant a seed? You nourish it. And I decided to go around the country and sit down with Klan leaders and Klan members to find out, how can you hate me when you don't even know me?
Shannon, we only have a minute left, but what is the best advice, one thing somebody could do if they end up talking to someone who hates?
I think to help them feel truly heard validate their viewpoint and make it absolutely unequivocally clear that you do not agree, and that in America that level of hate and objectification of other human beings is unacceptable.
But hear them out.
Yes, hear them out.
That
you you can't fight an enemy you don't know.
That is former skinhead Shannon Martinez, mother of seven. She lives in Athens, Georgia. We also spoke with Sammy Rangel, who's the executive director of the nonprofit group Life After Hate. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This week, the University of Texas at Austin removed three Confederate monuments from its campus overnight. That expulsion came in the wake of Charlottesville. In Atlanta, a debate brews over a different kind of Confederate monument, street signs. Atlantan Joe Thomas wants Confederate Avenue to be renamed. It goes through the Grant Park and Ormwood Park communities. Thomas's online petition to change its name already has nearly 8,500 supporters. He says the street name does not belong in the city he loves.
I grew up on Emerson Avenue, which is a few blocks away from Confederate Avenue. Confederate Avenue was a big part of growing up for me. I mean, it's basically how we got out of the neighborhood heading west. So heading to the Braves game, we used Confederate Avenue. When we went to the zoo all the time, we used Confederate Avenue. My school bus stop was on Confederate Avenue. You know, the street is named Confederate Avenue because the Confederate Veterans Convalescent Home was located on that street. That context is not provided in a street sign. I'm afraid people seeing that street sign for the first time that the misconceptions and the stereotypes about the Deep South will be perpetuated. The Saturday where there was all this white supremacist violence in Charlottesville, Virginia, surrounding their statue of Robert E. Lee, made me take a look at what we could do in the city, which is a city that I'm super proud of and I love living here. What can we do in this city to show that we're going to take these things very seriously, and we're going to be a place where we don't give our hateful past places of honor and memorialize them without providing the proper context. The reason I want to change the street name is that I don't think that there's room on a street sign to provide the context necessary. Museums are a great place to add historical context to symbols and statues. A street name, there's literally not enough room to put that context on there. Also, a street sign is a piece of government property, and my fear is that having a street named Confederate Avenue will be seen as tacit government endorsement of the Confederacy. If we're going to give places of honor to things from our history, they should be things that we're all proud of and that we can all celebrate.
That's Atlanta resident Joe Thomas sharing his reasons for wanting Atlanta's Confederate Avenue renamed. Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed is reviewing petitions to rename streets that have Confederate connotations. In a statement, he says he will assemble a group of advisors to recommend how to determine the future of each street name and marker. Last week, President Trump revoked another Obama-era executive order. It required projects built with federal aid be designed to handle sea level rise due to climate change. Trump says he nixed that order to reduce time and regulations for pending infrastructure projects. Earlier this year, we talked about how the scientific community is responding to climate change denial by the White House with Peter Dykstra of Environmental Health News. I started the conversation by playing a clip of then-candidate Donald Trump speaking to the Miami Herald.
Many years ago, I believe it was in the 1920s, they talked about the phenomena of global cooling. They thought the planet was getting cooler. Now they think the planet is getting warmer. Nobody knows for sure. Nobody knows for sure.
Peter, nobody knows for sure. Can you answer that?
I want to speak specifically to the global cooling nonsense because that's just got to go away. I'm going to turn 60 years old next month. The possibility of global cooling was raised in the scientific community about 2 weeks before my senior prom. You know, we've been in the Beyonce and Jay-Z era. That is from the Captain and Tennille equivalent era of science. It's long been dismissed. It's a durable talking point. These things often don't die through climate denial. And it's alarming to see climate denial alive in the cabinet, in charge of House and Senate committees, and in the White House. We're the only country in that status in the world, the only one.
So, Peter, let me play you another comment from the president. Again, this is from his interview with the Miami Herald in August.
Certainly climate has changed. You know, they used to call it global warming. They've had many different, they call it extreme weather. They always change the name to encapsulate everything. The problem we have is our businesses are suffering. Our businesses are unable to compete in this country because other countries aren't being forced to do what our businesses are being forced to do.
Okay, he makes two arguments there, Peter. Let's deal with the first one, which is his idea that they're constantly changing the name.
Climate change and global warming have been used interchangeably for a long time. It's not a conspiracy. There are different ways to define not what's going to happen, but what's already happening. And there's been an effort to paint this alleged name change as some sort of conspiracy theory. The denial is so deep that it seems we're denying even a 1% chance that what the vast majority of the scientific community in the world is telling us is true.
But Peter, what kind of fear is there among the scientific community that there could be censorship, especially in light of some of the ways in which federal scientists have been silenced or at least threatened with silence in the past few weeks?
Well, and web pages have disappeared. Climate scientists being threatened or harassed or sued or Freedom of Information Act requested within an inch of their lives is nothing new. This has been going on for a long time. I don't think folks are aware of just exactly how much political, ideological, possibly financial pressure the science community is under for just doing its job on these issues.
That was Peter Dykstra of Environmental Health News. In June, we spoke with Matt Hauer, a UGA demographer, researching how sea level rise will drive coastal Georgians inland. I started by asking him how he knows the sea level will rise 6 feet over the next century.
In terms of population processes and sort of understanding what that entails, what a 6 foot rise in sea level would mean in the coastal areas of the U.S., we know coastal areas are among the fastest growing in the United States and really across the world. People love being in coastal communities. And so when you kind of combine rising sea levels with rising coastal populations, you get quite a few people that are threatened by sea level rise in the U.S. And sea level is kind of unique. Sea level rise is unique compared to the other climate stressors like drought or extreme heat, and that it involves the conversion, essentially the conversion, of habitable land to inhabitable water.
That was Matt Hauer, a University of Georgia demographer. Just ahead, an acclaimed director steps off stage and into the classroom. We talk with Tony Award winner Kenny Leon. This is On Second Thought. It's on Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow we talk with the creator of an influential comic book character named Brother Man. And we want you to join that conversation. What fictional character became an inspiration for you in real life? Call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457 or post on social media. And be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Kenny Leon won a Tony for directing the Broadway revival of Raisin in the Sun. He directed The Wiz and Hairspray for live television and the remake of Steel Magnolias with Queen Latifah. That's just a tiny portion of his resume. He founded the True Colors Theater here in Atlanta, and he will now teach at Kennesaw State University, conducting a series of masterclasses for students there. And he joins us in studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste. Good to be here.
So as I understand it, you are in the middle of preparing a Broadway production of Children of the Lesser God, which opens in April.
That's true.
And you also have a 10-part miniseries for Fox coming, which is on the history of the Cotton Club in Harlem.
How did you know that? Yes, that's true.
You can find all this stuff. And yet you yourself called Kennesaw State University and says, please add something else to my schedule.
That's true. Yeah, because, you know, a couple of years ago, I had the opportunity to be the Denzel Washington chair of theater for Fordham University, where he went to school. And this sort of fellowship allows you maybe 2 quarters every Monday for like 10 weeks, 8 to 10 weeks. And I had these students for 3.5 hours. And I did a class on creating character on and off stage in a way to sustain you in this business. And it was so rewarding to me. You know, every other week I would have someone stop by, like Denzel would stop by 1 week, and then Felicia Rashad would stop by, Spike Lee came by. So it was a great experience for the students. And every week for 3.5 hours, I would have to come up with stuff to give them that I thought would help them in their young lives. And it was so rewarding to me. In that situation, they were able to pay me, so I didn't do it free, but to pay me in a way that I can go to my agent and say, okay, look, let's shut it down. No commercial theater, no TV, no film for this, you know, this amount of time, because I want to do this. And so then I, you know, it stuck in my head. I was like, that was such a great experience. And I love giving to young people. You know, I love giving back. And I see myself in them. So I said, okay, I'm a working artist. I can do that, but I just can't be a full-time teacher. And I respect teachers so much. You know, teachers are so underappreciated in our industry. But what I realize is that there's a disconnect between what young people learn about musical theater and what they learn about dramatic theater or commercial theater or regional theater and what's actually happening in the business. So I was like, I'm one of those guys that can, like, you know, I can bring those two worlds together. So I sort of wanted to do that and spend a little more time with students, but I couldn't afford to be a full-time teacher. So I had approached folks in other cities, you know, like in Philadelphia, New York, and, you know, people always, you know, when you're away from Atlanta, it's like everybody in other parts of the country love you, you know. It's like, oh, come on in, spend some time with our students. And so I was like, you know what? I need to find that in Atlanta, you know. Granted, I'm only here 30% of the time, but wouldn't it be great if I could spend some of that time with young people? And it was a two-way street, so they got something out of it, and I got something out of it. So I approached the folks, Patty Poulter and the folks over at Kennesaw, and I came up with a plan. I said, I'll do 4 master classes. And around this topic, and I'll spend time with the students, with the faculty, and you know, with writers, directors, actors. And so I approached them, and they came back, and we agreed on how it was going to work. And this past Saturday was my first of the 4 with them, and it was great. You know, it was, you know, 4 hours of just, and my only
thing. You got them to put down their phones?
Yes. Well, that's the thing. It's like if your phone goes off, that's $10. I do that in all my rehearsals, too. So it's like the phone can't go off. Shut it down. We got 4 hours to be together. And the deal is I will be as honest and truthful to you as you will be to me. And so if whatever they ask, I have to treat them like they're my own child. and I give them the truth. And I try to give them with love, and with, I give them the hard love. I tell them 80% of a successful actor's life is rejection, you know. But if you have to do this, it is a very rewarding profession, but also it's a responsibility, especially during the time, when we look at things in our country now, you know, it's a place for artists to speak what's in your heart. It's a time to speak about race. It's a time to speak about the way things are in our relationship to other countries. And historically, it's always been young folks. You know, so I sneak that in, you know, and I remind them that I was a political science major. I just happened to find my life as an artist. So there is always politics beneath my art.
Well, let's hear a little bit of a production of Fences. Speaking of Denzel Washington, mm-hmm. With Denzel Washington and Viola Davis here.
I'm trying the best I can to explain it to you. It's not easy to admit that I've been standing in the same place for 18 years.
Well, I've been standing with you. Right here with you, Troy. I got elected too. I gave 18 years of my life to stand in the same spot as you. Don't you think I ever wanted other things? Don't you think I had dreams and hopes? What about my life? What about me?
That is a play by August Wilson, and you actually sponsor the August Wilson monologue competition mm-hmm. for high school kids. So, mm-hmm. like, dealing with kids is already part of your effort. But what makes August Wilson particularly good, even for somebody as young as a high schooler?
Well, what makes, well, number one, selfishly, we started the August Wilson competition. Todd Kreitler, who was August's assistant, and myself, we selfishly started that because we want to figure out a way to keep August alive. And it's like,
that doesn't seem selfish, though.
It's like, how do you keep it alive? I don't know. It was like just really personal. You know, we spent the last 5 months with him working on his last play, and I just didn't believe he was going to die. And when he passed away, it was like, wow, man, how do we keep our friend alive? And we put these 10 great plays that he wrote, we put them into the hands of 9th to 12th graders. And we let them interpret what it means to them. And what we found, unlike any other writer, is that he writes for the common man in a very specific, unique way, you know. Some people say he's like Shakespeare, but when I look at Shakespeare, Shakespeare also writes about kings and queens. And you know, and what August writes about is the kings and queens in our neighborhood, in our inner city neighborhood. So he writes about the guy that runs the barbershop and the lady who works at the beauty parlor. And he writes about Troy Maxson, who was a garbage man. And, you know, he writes about people who are trying to find their way between politics and between politics, the responsibility to politics and responsibility to community. So they find themselves in the plays, and it's so exciting now. We started with one school in Atlanta, and we say at Tri-Cities, and we say find a monologue in any of the 10 plays, regardless of gender, regardless of race, and that speaks to you, and then work on it, and work on articulation, work on diction, work on commitment, work on honesty. And so we started at one school, and now we're in 12 different cities. So as the national competition, True Colors in Atlanta, we also sponsor the national competition. We are a regional partner, but we sponsor and raise the money for the national. So during the nationals, we fly the finalists from all these 12 cities to New York City. Many of them have never been on a plane before. Delta Airlines is our sponsor, so shout out to Delta. And we fly these kids in, then they go to New York City. Many of them have never been to New York City. And then they meet a celebrity friend. It might be somebody like Dan Radcliffe or Sam Jackson.
And Daniel Radcliffe, star of the Harry Potter films.
Yeah. Yeah. So whoever's on Broadway or whatever, I'll reach out and ask one of them, come in and talk to the young folks. And then I do a workshop on career building, thinking about the future. And because all of the 10 plays say the same thing. It's like no matter how your people got here, if it was on the bottom of a slave ship, or if your people came here seeking political freedom or religious expression, whatever, America belongs to you. It belongs to all of us. So that's what the 10 plays say. So I empower them to claim America. And then they get a chance to see two Broadway shows. Like, year before last, they saw Hamilton. You know, when their parents couldn't even get tickets for Hamilton.
I got them to
see Hamilton, and then Lin-Manuel and the cast, Chris Jackson, all of them came out to speak to the group. So they were like, their minds were blown. And so they saw a great show. They got to speak to these great artists. And their minds were open in terms of what they want to be. If they want to be a lawyer, doctor, whatever, America belongs to you. And then on Monday night, that Monday, they stand on stage and use their monologue, and they perform it on a Broadway stage at the August Wilson Theater on Broadway. So we do that every year, and that's very exciting. So it's always about trying to find a way to serve, and especially serve the future of America. And, you know, connecting to young people is something I love to do.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Tony Award-winning playwright and director Kenny Leon. Let's hear another clip. This is from the TV production of Hairspray, and the voice we hear is Ariana Grande singing Can't Stop the Beat.
So what do you have to say, Penny?
I am now a checkerboard chick.
You can't stop a river as it rushes to the sea. You can try to stop the hands of time, but no, it just can't be. And if they try to stop the seaweed, I call the eyes of a lazy bee.
So past experience has shown that directing a musical live on TV is not as easy even as you might think. It is that seems to be quite difficult for people to get right. How do you do that? And how different is that from a Broadway play?
Well, first of all, you said I was a playwright and director. That's not true. I have more respect for writers. I'm a director and an actor. It's mostly a director and a producer. But I love writers. So Harvey Fierstein did a great job with The Wiz for television and with Hairspray. But
adapting
I have to
it.
Tell you that a live television musical is the most difficult thing I've ever attempted to do. And so to this day, that probably is the most rewarding for me.
Because it's so hard?
Yeah, and also because it calls up everything that I've learned. You know, it's like, the skills I've learned from being an artistic director, because you have to navigate through all of the departments of network television. I had 800 people, 800 people on the crew to get Hairspray up. That's more people.
Right there in the room making everything.
Yeah, so, you know, and they're like somebody's own sound, somebody's own costume. It's 800 people to make that happen. So you have to lead those folks, and you have to be able to articulate a tone and a pace. And then, you know, I had a great television director on that. My mind's going blank. Alex Ruzinski. And so he's coordinating the movement of the cameras. I'm coordinating the movement of the actors. I'm giving the actors all the tone and how to be in the same world. And then I have to come and get together, work with him to see how we're going to shoot it. And then everything leads to that night. You put 3 or 4 months of work into one night, and then it's over. So you have opening, previews, and closing
all
in one
night.
So it's you fly without a net. And it's like I always tell folks, it's like it's not like the networks. You know, Bob Greenblatt at NBC started all this stuff, but it's like he didn't know how to do it all. You know, he just believed in it. And so when I step on out there with The Wiz, which was very different from Hairspray, and then step up and do Hairspray, it's like we don't know exactly how am I going to get these people across these 14 different locations in the 3 minutes I have for a commercial. I don't even know if that's possible. And ready to go and to sing on pitch in the right key on that night, given that they're also nervous and it's live.
Yeah.
And you can't
right
go back
and yeah. Yeah. We have just a couple minutes left, and I want to play you this comment from Derek Williams, the actor. This is an interview for Playbill, and he's talking about an encounter he had with a young student actor.
And this young black kid came to me, and he said, you know, I saw you as Fiero, and I just got to tell you, it meant the world to me. And it made me realize that I can do these other parts, and it's not just, you know, I'm not just limited. He said it doesn't limit me. My skin color does not limit me. And he's saying that, and it shook me. And I think I walked away, and I don't know if I cried, but I was. It just meant it showed me how much that moment meant to a lot of kids out there.
So in the 2 minutes that we have left, you have said before that the reason you keep teaching is because you get as much as you give. What do you mean? What is it you're getting?
I am a Christian. So I believe, people don't look good in hate. I believe that the more you give, it's better to give than receive. And every of those good principles, every time I've tried one out, it always works. It's like there's no amount of money. I'll tell you a quick story. I was going into a fast food store, which I hardly ever do, and there was a woman there, an 18-year-old woman, and she was, and it was an inner-city kid, and she was able to just, you could see she was working hard to articulate, to be gracious, to do her job so well. And I was like, that hit me. So I said, here's $20. And she said, what's that for? I said, that's for you. She says, why? I said, because you did your job so beautifully, and I just wish the world for your future. Her manager came out and said, excuse me, sir, did you give her $20? I said, yeah. Why? Because I wanted to. She did her job. And I love being able to, we have to help each other, you know what I mean? And some situations are more difficult than others. But me giving her that $20 felt better than if someone had paid me $1 million for a job. Give me $1 million, I don't want that, but give me what that girl felt when I gave her that $20, I'll take it any day.
That is award-winning director and producer Kenny Leon. Such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good to see you.
That's it for today, but we would love to hear from you. We've been talking about Confederate monuments as cities and universities across the country remove them. Is there one or maybe lots where you live? Call us. Describe a monument in your community. Tell us what it means or doesn't mean to you. Our number is 404-500-9457. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.